Hello and welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, February 11th on Iris. I'm your reader, Erin. Our first article on the front page, busy winter lifts local ski resorts. Abundant natural snow and limited indoor recreation lead to a booming season at Sundown and Chestnut by Eric Hogstrom. Ethan Melly added another layer to his closing on a bitterly cold but brightly sunny recent day at Sundown Mountain Resort outside of Dubuque. Quote, I've been here 4 or 5 times already this year, Melly said. The experience is awesome, end quote. Melloy, 14, of Saloon, Iowa, is among a growing number of snowboarders and skiers packing local ski slopes during a winter of abundant natural snow and limited indoor recreational opportunities due to COVID-19. Quote, people want to get outside, end quote, said Jeff Hanley. Quote, they want to be in the fresh air, and you can socially distance on skis. You've got things on your feet that keep you away from other people, end quote. Hanley of Dubuque has been a ski patrol member at Sundown for the past 25 years. He rarely has seen the slopes be as popular as they are this winter. Quote, I'm there on the hill on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, and I have seen at least a 30% increase in our crowds, end quote, Hanley said. Quote, it has been spectacular, end quote. Mike Murphy, general manager of Chestnut Mountain Resort outside of Galena, Illinois, said his slopes have also seen an approximately 30% increase in visitors this year over the 2019 to 2020 season. Quote, we're having a pretty good go at it, he said. The snow this winter had been a help, and what really has helped more were the moderate temperatures we had until this week, end quote. The opportunity to ski has drawn customers from throughout the region and beyond, Murphy said. Quote, we had some Arkansas people here recently, he said. Illinois restrictions related to COVID-19 have kept Chestnut's indoor restaurants closed, but Murphy said the resort was adapted. Quote, we created a couple of outdoor eating areas, and we have some nice picnic tables out on nicer days, and he said, and we do offer room service for guests staying with us, end quote. Chestnut has 100 guest rooms, and Murphy said occupancy has been good. The resort has given guests an opportunity to work a little and a ski a little. Quote, our midweek business has picked up dramatically because people have been working from home, end quote, he said. Chestnut's COVID-19 policies include occupancy limits in buildings and on chairlifts. Quote, we're limiting ticket sales to limit capacity on the slope, end quote, Murphy said. The resort requires face coverings and social distancing measures in all of its indoor areas, in lift lines, and on chairlifts. Chestnut also is limiting occupancy in its rental shop, where equipment is sanitized after every use. Mark Gordon, Sundown's general manager, said the numbers of snowboarders and skiers have taken him by surprise since the resort opened for business in early December. Quote, we were planning for 100 people and we got 200 people. Then we planned for 200 and got 400, end quote, Gordon said of the progressively larger turnout on the slopes. Quote, we just have had a lot of more people that wanted to get out and ski. It's been amazing. We have seen a fuller parking lot than for many years, end quote. Sundown's COVID-19 safety precautions include requiring visitors to wear face coverings when they enter a building or are lined up for chair lifts. Quote, we also cap the number of people in our lodges, end quote, Gordon said. That capacity limit includes attendance at live music performances Sundown hosts in its North Lodge. Quote, we started out having one band on Saturday night, Gordon said. That morphed into bands on Saturday and Sunday, and that morphed into Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. We have an open floor plan in the North Lodge, so we took out some additional dividers to add more venue space. People like it, end quote. Sundown also launched an online registration system that allows people to get their rental equipment outside. Gordon said the system enables guests to hit the slopes within minutes of arriving at Sundown, while also reducing the number of people in lines for rentals indoors. Quote, that has been a game changer for us, end quote, Gordon said. Hanley said he, quote, floats all over the hill, end quote, in his role, which has included selling items in a shop and operating a chairlift. Quote, this year, we've had some great customers from out of town, he said. We had a group from Hannibal, Missouri recently, all 15-year-old girls. I talked to their parents later on in the day, and they said the girls had one of their best times in the past year. They took a lesson, got on our hill, and had fun, end quote. Melloy said Sundown is perfect for him. Quote, I snowboard, and I'm new to this, he said. What I like about Sundown is you can start off easy, and it gets progressively harder, end quote. Our next front page article, state local officials split on mask rules. Iowa Attorney General's office insists city and county governments have exceeded their authority as local mandates remain in place. By Benjamin Fisher. Mask mandates continue to be in place and enforced in the city of Dubuque and Dubuque County, even after Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds recently lifted a less stringent statewide order. Whether local municipal municipalities can issue such orders remains a hotly disputed topic, which Dubuque and Dubuque County officials among those saying the action is allowed, while the governor's state attorney general's office and at least one prominent local lawmaker are among those arguing the opposite. This has led to some confusion among local residents, which is visible to local law enforcement. Quote, in a perfect world, the state, county, and city would all have a unified response to this thing to make it less confusing for the citizens, end quote, Dubuque County Sheriff Joe Kennedy said. Quote, it's disappointing that they can get on the same page on this, end quote. The mandates. Dubuque City Council members voted in August to enact a mandate that all people older than two, with limited exceptions, must wear a face covering in indoor public settings and in outdoor settings when maintaining 6 feet of social distance is not possible. City officials and the Iowa League of Cities argued that the city can legally, quote, institute a face covering requirement, capacity limitations, or both, end quote, through the Home Rule Amendment to the Iowa Constitution passed by voters in 1968, allowing cities and counties to govern themselves. The amendment allows local governments to set standards more stringent than state law unless otherwise expressly prohibited, quote, to improve the peace, safety, health, welfare, and convenience of its residents, end quote. In November, Dubuque County supervisors followed suit, instituting a similar mandate for all of the Dubuque County outside of the city of Dubuque. County Attorney C.J. May III also said the county had the authority via the Home Rule Amendment. Dubuque County joined at least 10 cities and counties across the state to institute such mandates. The supervisors approved their mask mandate in November, days before Reynolds instituted less restrictive statewide rules, rules that she just lifted effective last Sunday. City and county public health officials were quick to announce that, even if those statewide rules were dropped, their respective mask mandates remain in place. The City of Dubuque mandate remains in place until the City Council votes to rescind it. The county mandate had a March 1 end date, but the County Board of Health and supervisors already have indicated they support extending it beyond that date. The Board of Health will discuss the matter again tonight during a meeting. Are they legal? The question of whether local municipalities can order such mask mandates remain uncertain, as there has been no report of it being challenged in the courts locally or in other areas of the state so far. Dubuque City Attorney Grenna Brumwell said her analysis from August has not changed. Quote, neither the state nor a court have done the necessary analysis to determine whether a local face covering requirement is irreconcilable with the state code, end quote, she wrote in an email. May did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Iowa Public Radio reported this week that in addition to Dubuque and Dubuque County, mask mandates remain in place in cities that include Cedar Rapids, Cedar Falls, Coralville, Des Moines, Iowa City, and North Liberty, and for counties that include Linn and Johnson counties. Meanwhile, Chief Deputy Attorney General Nathan Blake wrote in an emailed response that his office had not changed its opinion. They insist that local governments have gone beyond their authority to pass such mandates under the governor's emergency proclamation. Iowa Representative Shannon Lundgren, Republican of Peosta, posted in a lengthy opinion on her campaign Facebook page this week after applauding the governor's announcement, coming solidly down on Reynolds' side. She reiterated that to the Telegraph Herald, quote, the governor is not suggesting people not wear masks, she said. The governor did not require face masks from November until just recently. People complied and our numbers came down, end quote. Lundgren said that Reynolds has a, quote, good handle, end quote, on what is going on statewide and that local governments are just adding to the confusion. Lundgren, who co-owns Trackside Bar and Grill in Peosta, said only that her establishment would be following the governor's rules. Enforcement. Dubuque Police Chief Mark Dalsing said officers continue to enforce the city's mask mandate. Quote, it has not been revoked, he said. It was just that, in that meantime, the governor also had a proclamation. We're still under the belief that we're operating under home rule, so we will still be enforcing as such, end quote. He noted that Reynolds' order in November had a positive effect on people following public health measures to slow the spread of COVID-19. Quote, it seemed like when the governor's proclamation went into effect, we had less pushback on people being required to wear masks, he said. The frequency of police calls went down, end quote. Sheriff Kennedy said that with the county's authority being questioned, his department has taken pains to primarily educate those violating the mandate, having issued no citations since it took effect. Quote, in our line of work, we feel it's important when we charge somebody somebody is a person who committed a crime, he said. No officer wants to make bad case law. You don't want your name tied to something like that, end quote. Dalzain, though, said his department is treating the issue just like any other. Quote, if somebody doesn't believe the government should have seatbelt laws, we still enforce them, end quote, he said. Assistant City Attorney Maureen Kwan reported that since August, the city has issued 7 citations for violations. Quote, 4 of those citations are being contested, end quote, she wrote in an email. For now, Kennedy said he hopes that when his deputies enter a business, at least the workers are in compliance with the county's rules. Quote, business owners will say, we can't control what customers do, he said, and you can control your staff, end quote. In Jackson County, Iowa, County Attorney Sarah Davenport said its mandate, which carried no punishment, has been welcomed by some business owners. Quote, it was something they could point to and say, we're not requiring you to wear masks, it's the county, end quote, she said. Our last front page article, experts talk, listen to prevent suicide. Area mental health officials say pandemic adds to winter woes, by Annie Mell. In the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, people rallied together to support one another during an uncertain time. But as the pandemic stretches on, more people are showing signs of hopelessness, area health officials said. That in turn leads to higher rates of suicidal ideation. Experts urge people struggling with depression or anxiety, particularly now, to reach out to others for support. Quote, it's really hard to do, but there is help available, end quote, said Carrie Merrick, Vice President of Behavioral Health at Hillcrest Family Services. Quote, it is very common to withdraw, but that will only make it worse, end quote. While there are no nationwide totals for suicide in 2020 yet, there are indications that the pandemic is taking a toll on mental health. For example, about twice as many adults reported seriously considering suicide in June 2020 compared to the same period in 2018, according to a report from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Data from the nonprofit Mental Health America indicates that since COVID-19 pandemic began, more than 178,000 people nationwide have reported frequent suicide ideation, and 37% of people reported having thoughts of suicide on more than half of the days or every day in September. During the early months of the pandemic, people felt they were, quote, in this together, end quote, when it came to navigating a COVID-19 world, said Dr. Michael Porowski, a psychiatrist at Medical Associates Clinic. But as the pandemic wore on, more people started to struggle. Quote, more people are reaching out and saying, I need help getting through this, end quote, he said. Porowski said that in the past year, many of his patients have wondered if things would be better if they were not alive. When people are alone or feel they cannot reach out to others, feelings of depression can snowball, he said. Quote, we know that winter is a hard time in general for people when it's snowy and gray, he said. When you put on top of that a pandemic that's forcing us to live in ways most of us don't want to live, it makes it doubly challenging, end quote. Officials from Mental Health Disability Services of the East Central Region, which includes Delaware, Dubuque, and Jones counties, plan to allocate about $50,000 from the latest federal COVID-19 stimulus bill to suicide prevention, CEO May Higginton said. Quote, suicide prevention is all of our responsibility when we have friends or family members or whatever it might be that are close to us that might be feeling overwhelmed or in a way that they want to hurt themselves, end quote, she said. Harrington said her agency is working with Cedar Rapids, Iowa Nonprofit Foundation to Crisis Services to create an outreach training program to help people respond to someone experiencing suicidal thoughts. Quote, any single one of us can know a person thinking of harming themselves, and many of us don't know how to handle those conversations or don't know how to respond, end quote, she said. Higginton said East Central Region officials hope to offer the training sometime this year. Drew Martle, Director of Crisis Services at Foundation to Crisis Service, said his organization currently offers 2 suicide prevention trainings to groups and individuals age 16 and older. Quote, suicide is a massive problem in the United States, he said. It is a public health crisis and we need to lift the stigma around suicide, end quote. Merrick said there are signs that indicate someone might be experiencing suicidal ideation. She encouraged people to listen. If someone talks about being a burden to their loved ones or says that their family would be, quote, better off, end quote, without them, they might need support, she said. Quote, that's a huge red flag, she said. That is something to be taken very seriously, end quote. The best response to a concern that someone is thinking of suicide is to ask if they are okay and if they are having those thoughts, she said. Quote, the most important thing is not being afraid to talk about it, and using the word suicide is important, she said. It takes it out of the darkness, end quote. Moving to the Dubuque local section, Hinson talks local vaccination efforts. Lawmakers visit Crescent Community Health Center by Benjamin Fisher. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, Republican of Iowa, on Wednesday toured Crescent Community Health Center, which is precisely the type of provider she hopes will play a larger role in COVID-19 vaccination moving forward. According to CEO Gary Collins, the Dubuque Health Center has administered vaccine doses to its own staff, as well as at least 200 doses to other area health care workers not affiliated with the larger hospitals or clinics, but Crescent staff members have made their plans to play a larger role in the process. Hinson said that fits with her vision for future federal pandemic relief as well. Quote, the number one priority is how we can get that vaccine out, she said. Talking to them about how that can be administered really effectively through their care models here, I'm very excited about that. When I look at the coverage area of the counties they draw in to serve, those are areas that they need access, end quote. Hinson noted challenges accessing the vaccine in rural areas, low-income areas, and places with transportation challenges. Quote, that's where I see Crescent being a vital part in making sure we can get that to people who need it, she said. Ask them for specific examples for patients that what that care has meant to them. As I'm going to bat for our new federally qualified centers here in Iowa, I want to be able to say, look, here are the actual patient outcomes. If people are following through and have this care model, it's effective, end quote. Collins said he was excited to hear on Tuesday of President Joe Biden's plan to begin sending vaccines directly to community health centers like Crescent, one in each state to start with, then 250 nationwide in the second phase. Quote, there's a good chance that more than one of those will be in Iowa, and we hope one is us, he said. We already serve the underserved. That's broadly known across the country. And community health centers are working with more of those in the AIDS community, farm workers, homeless populations, limited English proficiencies, end quote. Hinson said that she thinks the next phase of federal pandemic relief is still a couple of weeks out and that it will not be the last. She said her seat on the U.S. House of Representatives Budget Committee will play a bigger role in relief packages later in the year. Quote, it sounds like if not this package, next package, we'll be able to offer amendments and actually engage more as a budget committee in the process, she said. We all realize that this is not over anytime soon. 2 months from now, 6 months from now, when we're dealing with the next reconciliation package, I can come to the table with real data of what they saw in 2020. They're saying 750% increase in telehealth through the health centers in Iowa. End quote. Prior to her tour at Crescent, Hinson met with law enforcement officials in Jones County and economic development leaders in Jackson County. Dubuque County records 34 new cases. Jackson County officials report that they expect to receive a steady supply of 400 vaccine doses each week during February, Telegraph Herald. Each day, the Telegraph Herald is recapping changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Wednesday's developments included no additional related deaths were reported between 5 p.m. Tuesday and 5 p.m. Wednesday for the Telegraph Herald coverage area. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, the local 14-day positivity rates in Iowa were 12% for Jackson County, 8.4% for Jones County, 8% for Delaware County, 7.3% for Dubuque County, and 5.3% for Clayton County. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, only one area long-term care facility remained on the state's outbreak list. Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque had 5 new cases in the previous 14 days. On Wednesday, the state provided county-level hospitalization data as of Tuesday afternoon. The data showed 12 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized, an increase of 4 from the previous release of data for Sunday. There were 3 such Jones County residents, a decrease of 1, 2 from Jackson County, unchanged, 1 from Clayton County, an increase of 1, and none in Delaware County, a decrease of 2. Jackson County officials reported that they expect to receive a, quote, steady supply, end quote, of 400 vaccine doses each week during February. About half of each shipment is being targeted to people ages 65 and older. Vaccinations for school staff are scheduled for this month as well. Statewide, Iowa reported 989 additional cases during the 24-hour period, increasing the state's total to 326,576 by 5 p.m. Wednesday, there were 29 additional related deaths reported, so the toll rose to 5,174. In Wisconsin, Tama Veterans Administration and Medical Center received a shipment of COVID-19 vaccine and only have until Friday, February 12th, to administer 2,000 doses. Appointments are open to veterans enrolled in in the Tomah VAMC to schedule appointments for today or Friday, call 800-872-8662, extension 66274. Grant County Health Department officials reported that a free public COVID-19 testing site will operate from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Friday, February 12th at the National Guard Army in Platteville, 475 North Water Street. Attendees are encouraged but not required to register at register.covidconnect.wi.gov. Lafayette County Health Department officials reported that they do not expect to receive more first doses of the vaccine for at least a week and asked residents not to call before February 22nd to ask about an appointment. Crawford County Public Health Department officials reported that they received 100 first vaccination doses and 70 second vaccination doses. Officials are scheduling individuals using a waiting list, and those interested in being added can call 608-326-0229. Statewide, Wisconsin reported 821 new cases Wednesday, pushing the total to 551,871. There were 35 additional related deaths recorded, so the state count moved to 6,129. In Illinois, the state reported 2,825 new cases Wednesday, along with 53 more related deaths. That pushed the state's total to 1,152,995 cases and 19,739 deaths. Moving to news in brief, Dubuque County sex offender sentenced to 10 years in prison, Piosta, Iowa. A Dubuque County sex offender recently was sentenced to 10 years in prison for another sex crime and other charges. Bryce A. Hines, 30, of Piosta, was sentenced in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County after previously pleading guilty to charges of third-degree sexual abuse, assault causing serious injury, and a parole violation as part of a plea agreement. Following his prison time, he will be on parole for the rest of his life. As part of the plea deal, a charge of false imprisonment was dismissed. Hines was arrested in October on warrants for the charges. Court documents state that he physically and sexually assaulted a woman he knew in August. The Telegraph Herald does not provide identifying information for victims of alleged sexual crimes. The Iowa Sex Offender Registry states that Hines was convicted of third-degree sexual abuse in 2014 in Clayton County. Two country stars announced for this year's Clayton County Fair, National Iowa. A pair of country music stars will take the stage this summer at the Clayton County Fair. Mark Wills will perform at 7:30 p.m. Thursday, August 5th at the fairgrounds in National, the fair announced Wednesday morning. Wills has had 19 songs land on the Billboard Country Airplay chart, including 8 in the top 10. They include number 1 hits 19 Something and Wish You Were Here, and several songs that peaked at number 2, Don't Laugh at Me, Back at One, and I Do Cherish You. Chase Bryant will perform at 8 p.m. Friday, August 6. Bryant has had 4 singles hit the Billboard Country Airplay chart, including top 10 hits Take It On Back and Little Bit of You. The Clayton County Fair is held the first week in August. The entrance fee to the fair covers admission to all activities and events. Police: woman seriously injured in building crash now charged. A Dubuque woman seriously injured when her vehicle struck a building last month was arrested this week. Danielle N. Meyer, 39, is charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with operating while intoxicated. Police report that Meyer was taken by ambulance to Mercy One at Dubuque Medical Center and later transferred to University of Iowa hospitals and clinics in Iowa City for treatment of serious injuries, including a compound fracture of her left arm on January 19th. Court documents state that Meyer was traveling north on Asbury Road at about 9 p.m., January 19th, when she failed to negotiate the curve at the intersection with St. Ambrose Street. Meyer's vehicle crashed into a telephone pole, fire hydrant, and fence before striking the coin shop, 1870 Asbury Road, causing $5,000 worth of damage. The Iowa Department of Public Safety's Criminalistics Laboratory performed a blood test that indicates Meyer's blood alcohol content was 0.127% at the time she arrived at Mercy One. Documents state the legal driving limit is 0.08%. Police, the Dubuque Police and Dubuque County's Sheriff Departments reported John D. Davis, the 5th, I believe, IV 35, was arrested at 10:59 a.m. Wednesday at his residence on a charge of domestic assault. Court documents state that he assaulted his father, John D. Davis, the 3rd, at their residence. Tobias C. Sarazin, 34, reported at about 2:20 p.m. Tuesday fraud of nearly $20,000. Moving to the opinion page for the letters to the editor, Iowa should not divert money from struggling schools. From Frank Belcastro, North Grand Avenue, Dubuque, Iowa should provide an excellent education for all children, not private school vouchers for a few. Vouchers are an incentive to start charter schools, which are practically responsible to no one. Voucher schemes divert public money away from public schools, especially at a time when Iowa has been underfunding its schools consistently. At a time when public schools face budget shortages, overcrowded classrooms, and increased accountability, taxpayer dollars should be spent on the improvement of schools. There is a finite amount of money for education. The money spent on vouchers is money the public schools do not get. According to Representative Lindsey James, Democrat of Dubuque, Iowa already provides millions in public tax dollars for private schools and homeschool assistance, including the AEA, which provides support to private schools for special education programs, health services, services for remedial education programs, guidance services, and school testing services. The DC school voucher scheme, despite 7 years and millions of taxpayer dollars, has not been adequately shown to improve academic achievement. Charters haven't lifted Detroit at all. Detroit continues to be the lowest performing school district in the nation. The federal test, the NAEP, shows that after 21 years of vouchers in Milwaukee, black students in the Milwaukee public schools score on par with black students in Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Louisiana. Not a great record. Vouchers are a failure. If you are dissatisfied, fisk the school that you have, but don't make it worse by diverting funds from it. Our next letter, Wisconsin voters, make your voice heard on fair legislative maps. From Claudia Luz, County Highway 2, Highland, Wisconsin. As an Iowa County, Wisconsin voter, I had the opportunity in November 2020 to vote on the non-binding redistricting referendum. My vote informed the state legislature of my demand that fair maps be drawn this year instead of gerrymandered ones, as was done in 2011. It passed overwhelmingly in my county with 73.8% in favor. Statewide results were similar at 67.9%. The people have spoken, but we need to make sure the legislators are listening and hold them to take action to provide fair maps that will in turn provide fair elections. Voters must choose their representatives rather than the other way around. Now is the time to make our voices heard again by presenting our concerns directly to the People's Map Commission, which is charged by Governor Evers with drawing new redistricting maps using a nonpartisan process. The commission is holding hearings throughout Wisconsin to get input from the public. The virtual hearing here in the 2nd Congressional District will be held on March 11th. If you want to help put an end to gerrymandering, please make your views known to the commission. For information about the People's Map Commission, how to submit written comments, or how to attend the virtual hearing, go to the commission's website, govstatus.egov.com/peoples-maps. Please don't miss this opportunity to play a part in the redistricting process. State legislators represent you. They must listen and carry out the will of their constituents. And the last letter, conservative columnist added needed viewpoint from Ronald Bensick, Sun Valley Drive, Asbury, Iowa. It was surprising and sad to hear a Telegraph Herald letter writer accuse Star Parker and Victor Davis Hanson of being, quote, shallow propagandists, end quote. I think they are intelligent, conscientious, and reasonable proponents of the conservative viewpoint. It is a major affront to our freedom of speech heritage to demand that they be censored and removed from the editorial page. Mr. Ramson's comment that his stats professor at Loras College stated that, quote, there are liars, damn liars, and statisticians, end quote, actually originated with Mark Twain, who had a unique talent for combining humor and cynicism. He has no basis in fact and proves nothing. Moving to the obituaries, Joseph L. Stelkin. Joseph, known as Joe Leander Stelkin, 91, of Dubuque, passed away Monday, February 8th at Bethany Home. Friends may greet the family from 9 a.m. until the 10 a.m. Mass of Christian burial on Saturday, February 13th at St. Anthony Catholic Church. The Mass will be live-streamed on the St. Anthony Catholic Church website, www.stanthony-dubuque.org. Reverend Stephen Rosenke will officiate. Masks and social distancing are required at church. Interment will be at Mount Olvet Cemetery. Military honors will be accorded by the Dubuque Marine Corps League. Arrangements are entrusted to Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 JFK Road, Dubuque. Condolences and memories may be shared at Eaglehoff Casper, SiegertCasper.com. A public celebration of life is planned for Saturday, July 24th, beginning at 11 a.m. at the Eagle Point Park Main Pavilion. Joe was born March 22nd, 1929, in Worthington, Iowa, the son of Bernard and Catherine Zita Fruth Stelkin. He married Lois O. Hay on October 6, 1962, at St. Columbkill Catholic Church. She preceded him in death on January 30th, 2003. Joe began his education in a one-room schoolhouse and went on to be the first in his family to graduate from high school. He then graduated from Bayless Business College. Joe served his country with the U.S. Air Force and was stationed at Hamilton Field in California from 1948 to 1952 and in Korea from 1951 to 1952 until his honorable discharge as a staff sergeant. He was employed at the Dubuque Packing Company for many years. Joe was an avid bowler throughout his life and bowled one of his best games at age 80. He was a long-suffering Cubs and Bears fan. Joe volunteered for bingo at St. Anthony's and as a pallbearer for St. Vincent de Paul Society. He delivered Meals on Wheels for over 20 years. Joe was honored to take one of the last honor flights out of Dubuque along with his brother-in-law and escorted, not babysat, by his son. Joe is survived by two children, Mark J., spouse Michelle Stelkin of Dubuque, and Mary Beth, spouse Roger Scott of Clive, Iowa. Six grandchildren, Alex Stelkin of Louisville, Kentucky, Jonathan, fiance Brooke Stelkin, and Jacob Stelkin, both of Dubuque, Trey Scott of St. Louis, Missouri, Leander Scott of Dillon, Colorado, and Turner Scott of Kirksville, Missouri. His sister, Laura May, known as Toots Carton of Earlville, Iowa. His in-laws, Dolores Stelkin of Manchester, Iowa. Vince Shrunk of Dubuque, Iowa. Lou Ann O'Hay and Mary McGrath, both of Dubuque. Donald's spouse, Colleen O'Hay of Rockford. And Ann and Mary O'Hay, both of Dubuque. And many nieces and nephews. In addition to his wife, he was preceded in death by his parents, his siblings Aurelia, spouse Gerald Graw, Bernard, spouse Grace, Arthur, Elmer, spouse Betty, and Jerome, spouse Jane Stelkin, and Irene Shrunk, and his in-laws Omer, known as Flea Carton, and Delmer, Jeanette, and Gerald O'Hay. Joe's family would like to thank Hospice of Dubuque, especially Chris Bethany's Home Memory Care and Dr. Chris Style. Memorials may be made to Hospice of Dubuque. Margaret E. Griffin, Benton, Wisconsin. Margaret E., known as Marty Griffin, 94, of Benton, Wisconsin, died Monday, February 8, 2021, at home. A massive Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 13, 2021, at St. Patrick's Church, Benton, Wisconsin, with Reverend David Flanagan officiating. Services will be live streamed through Facebook on the funeral home face page. Burial will be in the church cemetery. A public visitation for friends will be held from 9 to 10:45 a.m. Saturday at the church. The family requests you utilize masks during the duration of your visit in the church and that you practice social distancing. Casey McNett Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Benton is assisting the family. Marty was born on December 2, 1926 in Benton, Wisconsin, the daughter of John, known as Kelly, and Regina McGuire Milner. She married Micah Griffin on October 30, 1948. He preceded her in death on January 6, 1993. Marty's volunteered at St. Patrick's Church for many years, including caring for the church, cemetery, and Father Mazul Jelzy's little house, which she helped renovate. She collected dolls, antiques, and mining equipment with her husband. Margaret loved reading the newspaper and having pasty on Labor Day. Survivors include many nieces and nephews. She was also preceded in death by her parents, four sisters, Jean spouse Bob Ham, Esther spouse Al Hinger, Ruth spouse Dennis Averkamp, and Barbara spouse Raymond Lang, and two brothers, John Milner and Paul spouse Alberta Milner. The family wishes to thank the Benton Police, Benton Rescue Squad, and a special thank you to Bruce Cruiser. In lieu of flowers, a Margaret E. Griffin Memorial Fund has been established. Online condolences for the family may be left at www.caseymcnett.com. Helene M. Reuter, it's H-E-L-E-N-E, Bloomington, Wisconsin. Helene M. Reuter, 94, of Bloomington, died on Thursday, February 4th, 2021. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to noon, Monday, February 15th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Bloomington, where a massive Christian burial will be held at noon. Burial will be in St. Mary's Cemetery. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory of Bloomington is assisting the family. Jennifer A. Dunkel, Dyersville, Iowa. Jennifer A. Dunkel, 42, of Dyersville, passed away Monday, February 8, 2021, at her home surrounded by her family after a long battle with cancer. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, February 12, 2021, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, February 13th, at Kramer Funeral Home, where a memorial service will commence at 10:30 a.m. Burial will be at St. Francis Cemetery. Jennifer was born August 11, 1978, in Iowa City, the daughter of Paul and Susan Dickman Dunkel. She married and had two beautiful children, but later divorced. She graduated from Western Dubuque High School with the class of 1997 and attended Capri College in Dubuque. She was a manager at Payless Shoes and later at Walgreens until she became ill. She was a very caring individual who put others before herself. She loved her family and friends, being outdoors camping, birdwatching, and bargain hunting at sales. Jennifer is survived by her two children, Mitchell and Ziva, parents Paul and Sue Dunkel of Dyersville, one brother, Terry spouse Carmen Colker Dunkel, and their children, Cole and Kylie of Rickardsville, and many aunts, uncles, cousins, and friends. She is preceded in death by her maternal grandparents, Ralph and Alice Digman, paternal grandparents James and Lorraine Dunkel, uncles James Dunkel Jr., Stephen and James Digman, and Ernie Offerman. Information available at www.kramerfuneral.com. Cards may be sent to the family and care of Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, Iowa, 52040. Mary N. Melson, Dickeyville, Wisconsin. Mary N. Melson, 91, of Dickeyville, died on Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. on Saturday, February 13th, at Holy Ghost Catholic Church in Dickeyville, where services will be held at 11 a.m. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Hooden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Cuba City is assisting the family. Moving to sports, Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week, Devin Tiggs, Dubuque Hempstead. Tiggs develops himself into the state swimming qualifier, by Shannon Mum. The progression of Devin Tiggs' high school swimming career has been nothing short of amazing. During his first 3 years at Dubuque Hempstead, he fell short of qualifying for the Iowa State Swim Meet. This year, in his final season, he qualified in all four of his events. The Telegraph Herald Athlete of the Week has dropped 14.57 seconds off his 500-yard freestyle time over the course of a year. While reaching the goal he set as a freshman of breaking the 5-minute mark, he swam a 4:56.83 at the district meet Saturday. Quote, Devin is having a great senior year, and quote, Hempstead coach Rick Loflalhouse said, quote, he has put in a ton of work and he gets it after it every day. He has developed great technique and endurance, and that's a credit to his work ethic, end quote. During his freshman season, Tiggs developed a passion for swimming. Quote, I really fell in love with the sport that year, and I quickly realized this was something I wanted to commit to, end quote, he said. Tiggs joined the Dubuque Area Swim Hurricanes and soon found himself in the pool twice a day. Quote, I've been blessed to have some really wonderful coaches here at Hempstead with D-, end quote, he said. Quote, I would not be where I am today without them or my great teammates, end quote. Tiggs is seated 25th in the 200 freestyle and 23rd in the 500 freestyle. He will also swim as part of the 15th seated 200 and 400 freestyle relays in Saturday's state meet at Lynn Mar. Quote, I was definitely emotional on Saturday when I realized I would be competing at the state meet, he said. It's a great feeling to see that 4 years of hard work has paid off, end quote. Tiggs earned second team honors in the medley rally relay, 500 freestyle, and 400 freestyle relay on the Mississippi Valley Conference All-Valley Division squad. Quote, Devin has really showed up when it's mattered most, end quote, Lofel Halls said. Quote, he's proof that sticking to something and working hard can lead to great success. The amount of progression he's had throughout his career has been such a neat thing to see, end quote. Tiggs also helped recruit new swimmers to the Hempstead team. Quote, I just noticed that participation was kind of low, so I wanted to try to get as many guys to give it a try as I could, Tiggs said. I was really pleased with the numbers that decided to come out for the team, and I've had a bunch of them come up and thank me for asking them to join. They all fell in love with it just like I did, end quote. College basketball, Iowa 79, Rutgers 66, Weiskamp leads Iowa, by John Boschenkamp, the Associated Press, Iowa City. Joe Weiskamp scored 26 points and Luca Garza overcame a slow start to score 22 as number 15 Iowa beat number 25 Rutgers 76 79-66 on Wednesday night. The Hawkeyes 14-6, 8-5 at Big Ten, who fell out of the top 10 of the Associated Press poll this week for the first time this season, were coming off a stretch of 4 losses in the last 5 games. Weiskamp, who had 16 points in the first half, added 10 rebounds for his third double-double of the season. Garza, the nation's leading scorer at 25.5 points per game, missed his first 5 shots and didn't score until the 8-minute mark of the first half. He had just 8 points in the first half on 2 of 10 shooting, but was 6 of 10 from the field in the second half. Garza also had 10 rebounds for his 9th double-double of the season. Jordan Bohannon had 12 points for the Hawkeyes. Geo Baker led Rutgers 11-7, 7-7 with 11 points, and Jacob Young added 10. Another milestone. Garza passed the 500-point mark for the 2nd consecutive season. He is the 11th Hawkeye to have 2 seasons of 500 points or more, and he's only player in the program's history with 4 seasons of 400 or more points. Frederick starts. Iowa guard CJ Frederick returned to the starting lineup after missing 2 of the last 3 games with a lower leg injury. Frederick played 17 minutes and didn't score, missing all 3 shots he took. Frederick has started all 17 games he has played in this season, but Iowa coach Fran McCaffrey said earlier in the week Frederick would be, quote, day-to-day, end quote, for the rest of the season with the injury. Big picture, it was a timely victory for the Hawkeyes as they head into a stretch with games at Michigan State and Wisconsin. Rutgers, which came into the game at half game behind Iowa in the Big Ten standings, had a 4-game winning streak snapped. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Thursday, February 11th on Iris. I'm your reader, Aaron. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful day.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book entitled A Culinary History of Iowa. And this article, actually it says chapter 2, is entitled Immigrants Influence Iowa's Food Traditions. Hundreds of thousands of pioneers and immigrants from many parts of Europe and beyond flocked to Iowa in the 19th and early 20th centuries in search of a better life, whether that meant economic opportunity, religious freedom, or the chance to create a utopian society. These newcomers brought a variety of unique food traditions with them and transformed Iowa's culinary history. Some immigrants, like the French Icarians, were motivated by ideological ideals when they settled in America. The new state of Iowa, specifically Adams County, became the promised land for French men and women pursuing their dream to create a communal utopian society where everyone was equal. By some accounts, their Icaria colony in southwest Iowa was the longest existing non-religious, purely communal experiment in American history. The first Icarian party arrived in Iowa in 1852. They purchased about 3,000 acres of land from the United States government at $1.25 per acre to build their new colony near Corning. Living conditions in the untamed lands of southwest Iowa were often harsh. Log houses, some without wood floors or windows, were the French settlers' only shelter against the brutal winter. Most of the Icarians' land was unfenced, unbroken prairie, and there was not one settler along the trail before they reached Icaria, according to some reports. Supplies for the colony often had to be hauled overland for hundreds of miles. Only a few basic ingredients, including milk, butter, cornbread, and bacon, formed the daily menu. As a communal society, the Icarians worked together on the farms and ate together in a communal dining hall, where evening meals were sometimes followed by music or lectures, spoken in French. Little by little, living conditions in the colony improved as the Icarians managed to establish a fairly successful agricultural enterprise. When wool prices skyrocketed with the outbreak of the Civil War, the Icarians thrived by selling wool and other supplies to the Union Army. While the war ended in 1865, trouble was brewing in the Icaria colony by the 1870s. Much of the conflict revolved around little gardens, according to an April 1921 article in the Iowa History Journal, The Pelham Pest. Earlier in the history of the Icarian community in Iowa, each family had been permitted to cultivate a little garden around their log house where flowers might be raised. Some families had planted vines and even fruit trees. Now that these plants were bearing fruit, the more radical members of the colony could not tolerate this violation of their rules against private property. The possessors of the gardens, however, clung to their little plots of ground. It wasn't much, but it was theirs. The authorities tried to settle the quarrel with a compromise. As each family moved from their log house to a new frame house, their little garden was to be given up. There would be no simple resolution to this dispute, however, which triggered open hostilities. The radicals claimed that the community had violated its constitution and announced their intent to withdraw. They also advocated an aggressive style of communism and appealed to a circuit court to revoke the charter granted to the community in 1860 on the grounds that Icaria was really a communist establishment instead of an agricultural society, as the Articles of Incorporation provided. By 1879, a group of younger progressive colony members had split from the older, more conservative members. This marked the beginning of the end for the Icarians' utopian experiment in Iowa. In 1898, members voted to end the colony. By then, it consisted mostly of elders who could no longer continue the hard work of operating the colony. The Icarian movement in America was over. The legacy of the Icarian movement endures, however. The French Icarian Colony Board of Trustees was formed in recent years and has been rebuilding the French Icarian village on a portion of original Icarian land east of Corning. The 1878 refectory, communal dining hall, and 1860 one-room Icaria school have been restored for tours and research. History comes to life at the French Icarian village through events like the annual Fête de Mai, Festival of Corn, which is held in the fall. The original Fête de Mai was a celebration held by the Icarians each fall after all the crops were harvested. The feast was served in the communal dining hall to everyone who came to help on the final day of corn harvest. In late September 2015, the Cresta News Advertiser promoted the French Icarian Village's 4th annual Fête de Mai, which included a 4-course French supper featuring flavors of the Alsace region. It's a modern taste of the French Icarian's quest for utopia in Iowa. And that was an excerpt from A Culinary History of Iowa by Darcy Doherty Malsey and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Zofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once-weekly or twice-monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.